Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The poet Emily Dickinson famously lived a life of seclusion in her prominent family's manse in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a favorite white dress, tending flowers, writing letters, and writing some of the most remarkable poetry the world has ever known. Virtually unpublished when she died in 1886, she's now considered an American great. The great poetry scholar Helen Vendler is out with commentary on a new collection of her works this hour on Point. We're decoding Emily Dickinson. You can join the conversation. How do you read Emily Dickinson? Has she colored your world? Natural, intellectual, moral? How? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll hear from this year's Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Ray Armantrout, on Dickinson. But joining me now in the studio is acclaimed poetry critic, scholar Helen Vendler, professor of English at Harvard University. She's written famously on Wallace Stevens, Keats, Lowell, Shakespeare, many more. Her big new book out yesterday is Dickinson, Selected Poems and Commentaries. Helen Vendler, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You've written so much on so many poets, and now, deep in your career, you come to Dickinson. Why not until now?
Actually, this book was commissioned by the Harvard University Press, but I had already written on Dickinson a chapter in an earlier book called Poets Thinking. So I felt that I had been studying her for some time. I've taught her as well, so that there was a grounding. When they asked me to do this, I felt I could say yes.
Did you read her as a child, as a young woman?
I read her from the time I was about 12, and I memorized a lot of the poems at that time, and I was memorizing the old versions of the poems from the emended versions that her relatives put out and with Colonel Higginson. And they had taken out everything blasphemous, scandalous, unmaidenly, what have you.
So when you say emended, and when you take out all that, the blasphemous and the unmaidenly, that's taking out a lot of Emily Dickinson.
They changed the words that would give scandal. And they changed taints to paints, for instance, anything like that. So then I had to learn them all over again in 1955 when the first respectable edition came out, the Johnson edition, and now there's a new edition by Ralph Franklin. So she keeps being renewed. The order of poems is different in the new edition from handwriting and also from Ralph Franklin's tracking the little booklets she made.
Right,
he actually
hand.
Tracked down the pinpoints and the watermarks and so on, reconstituting the booklets.
To match them up and get the chronological order of the production, or the order in which she wanted,
or at least the order
seen them read.
More rational, yes, than the more chaotic order of the Johnson, yes.
You know, I'm such a crazy fan of Emily Dickinson, the way she does so much in so few words, and the sort of freedom of her mind, mm-hmm. which maybe people don't associate with that Victorian, white dress, flower garden, big manse, and yet within that house, within her room, the freedom of this poet, it seems to me quite extraordinary.
No one knows how the self-taught become who they are. She had the largest library in Amherst. Her father's library was larger than that of Amherst College at the time, where he was a trustee. Mm-hmm. It's like Virginia Woolf, who had her father's library, too. And Walt Whitman, just because he was a newspaper man and writing editorials and whatnot, then was also a great reader and a great listener to music. So they make their way nonetheless.
These two, Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, seen as kind of stamping early American poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But she did not read him because she had told he was, what was the word?
She had been told he was disgraceful.
Disgraceful.
Yes. She was disgraceful herself, of course.
Right. That surprised me. He writes erotic poetry. She writes erotic poetry. What's the difference?
Well, I think the problem would have been having a volume of Whitman in the house, to tell you the truth. Her father would certainly not have approved. She requested certain volumes of her father, which he was willing to buy for her, but then he implored her not to read them. So what would he have made of Walt Whitman if Walt Whitman had come into the house? It would be clearly inadmissible within the precincts of that house.
And remind us, I mean, it's a famous story, but how it came to pass that in this great long life, where she produced nearly 1,800 poems, great mm-hmm. classics, many of them, and now that she was never published.
She
Or almost never, I guess anonymously, one or two.
Seven poems.
Mm-hmm.
She would have liked to be published, probably. She published widely in the sense that she sent many, many poems to friends in letters, mm-hmm. so that a lot of people were reading her poems.
In a time when letters were very important, and her circle was no mean circle.
No. So it wasn't as though she didn't want to disseminate her poems. She was afraid that if they were printed, they would be emended, and precisely what happened when they were printed. So she left them, but left them as a bequest to her countrymen. For love of her, sweet countrymen, think tenderly of me. She says, this is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. And so in leaving a legacy of the poem specifically to everyone in the United States, mm-hmm. she certainly was hoping for dissemination.
My letter to the world that never wrote to me. We're going to look at some of her poems and get some of your interpretation. There's much to say about the big picture with Emily Dickinson and her life, but we want to hear some of these poems and really go into them. Perhaps we start with one of her best known, the line that everybody knows, hope is the thing with feathers. You have it. Tell us a little about it. Perhaps read it for us, and then we'd like to hear, Helen Vendler, your thoughts on it.
Thank you. The word hope has been defined theologically forever. It's one of the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, mm-hmm. so that it has a long literary history. There's a poem called Hope by George Herbert, for instance. There's St. Paul saying that hope is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Mm-hmm. So it's been defined in very stately ways. When somebody says hope is a thing with feathers.
What?
Yes, exactly. What? And it's defined not as something coming from God, but as something that grows naturally or sings naturally in the human soul. The wonderful thing about hope, as she talks about it, is that it requires no reciprocity. It's a gift with no expectation of return from her. She doesn't have to give it anything. It never asks for food or anything else, but it keeps singing.
Will you read for us?
Yes. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me.
Hope is the thing with feathers from Emily Dickinson, and maybe I'm not reading this deeply enough, but this seems to me one of the most accessible Emily Dickinson poems.
It is in the sense that many of her poems are accessible. The words are simple. The lines are short. However, if you don't know the history of the word hope, mm-hmm. you don't see the originality of defining hope this way.
A kind of secular definition.
Secular and comic, almost, is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul.
Why that image?
The bird is an old image for the poet singing, so it's a self-image, too, that poems of hope keep arising in the soul without your even soliciting them. And she talks of herself as a bird elsewhere, too. Split the lark and you'll find the music other places. So that it's a self-image. It's very old. Keats has it in The Nightingale and so forth. It's interesting that she doesn't define the species of the bird here at all.
Not a bit. No. Big or small. Or, well, I guess she does
small.
Say little.
Yes, little.
The little bird at the window. Emily Dickinson, the great Emily Dickinson. Helen Vendler, the great scholar of poetry, is with us. And we have callers already. I want to begin to bring them in. Shoreham, Vermont. Peter, you're on the air, Peter.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. She's my favorite poet, and I think her work and accomplishments are on a par with the cave paintings of Lascaux, that she toiled in obscurity and paid forward her genius and wonder to all of us. And
That's great.
The Hope poem was my favorite, but then I discovered my book of Emily's, Mrs. Dickinson's poems, on a random basis, and the brain is wider than the sky.
Can you recite it for us?
Certainly. The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will contain with ease, and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges, buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, for heft them pound for pound, and they will differ, if they do, as syllable from sound.
Syllable from sound. That is so fantastic. Peter, I'm so glad you share that with us. And when you read that, what does it bring you?
Well, I think it's how humans are part in the universe. This is what the universe is. We are, it's as big as we are. And I find it as, that is an astounding observation on her part, and explains just how we can conceive and the sense of wonder that we have to perpetuate to make a life, to just keep life going for everyone.
Peter, I'm so very happy for your call. And Helen Vendler, when, as Peter reads, and of course the poem says, the brain is just the weight of God. Is that her blasphemy? It's bold.
It reads like that. This is, of course, a boast poem, and boast poems are never thought to be exactly literal. When you celebrate the achievements of a hero or something, you're not tied to literal fact. But I love that reading, Peter. Thank you for reading it so well on the air, and thank you for including that. It's one of my favorites, too. If you permit me to add one comment, It's at the end when she says that the brain is just the weight of God, and then suggests that you hold God in one hand and the brain in the other, and heft them pound for pound,
yes,
weigh them, and they will differ if they do. And then she makes the great distinction. God can make sounds. Mm-hmm. He made the universe. He can make all those sounds of the universe. But only poets can make syllables.
Or humans.
Out of sounds. Or humans, yes. And to make a syllable, to make language, is the distinctive human act.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the poetry of Emily Dickinson, an American original, with the great poetry scholar Helen Vendler, who her wonderful new volume is Dickinson Selected Poems and Commentaries, 150 of the nearly 1,800 poems written, very few published in her lifetime, by Emily Dickinson. Helen Vendler is with me in the studio. And how did you do it? 150 out of nearly 1,800.
Well, when they asked me to do this, it was supposed to be 100 poems when the press asked me. And first I thought, I'll go through the poems and just mark the indispensable ones. And after I had marked the indispensable ones, I had 400 poems.
Oh, no.
And I was supposed to do 100.
Right.
Finally, I got it cut down to 138.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said to my editor, I can't cut it any further. You do the rest of the cutting. And he
so
said, well, let's make it 150.
The publisher.
So
right.
I had to do another 50% of
right,
work.
Right, right.
But I was glad to do that. I was glad they would sponsor the 150, mm-hmm, because it is only less than a tenth of her work.
You write about her, you say, you know, you've got the whole waterfront, her first-person poems, her poems of grand abstraction, her ecstatic verses, her depictions of emotional numbness, her comic anecdotes, her painful poems of aftermath. I mean, there was not much that she didn't touch from that little room.
No, and she knew that the cultural, measures for measuring everything else did not measure human emotion. Human emotion lives in some latitudeless place, and those places that we can't give longitude and latitude lines for, by which we orient ourselves in real life, have to have their own map. So she's creating, you might say, new longitude and latitude lines around the world to enable us to place ourselves on the emotional map of the world.
Could you get a sense from reading those 1,800 poems and looking so deeply at this 150, how did she find this voice? I mean, you remind us, you know, the King James Bible was there, but she read Shakespeare and Milton and Wordsworth and Keats and Eliot and Bronte and Elizabeth Barrett Browning, you name it. And yet she's like, you know, in a way, none of them.
No.
In her poetry.
She is, well, no great poet is like anybody else.
Yes.
So there's that. She also said, if one has Shakespeare, does one need any other book? So she must have read Shakespeare very intensely. In fact, people have written on allusions to Shakespeare in the poems. And, of course, when she said, how do I know something is a poem? And she said, if I read it and it feels as though the top of my head is taken off, I know it. Is there any other way? So that when she read Shakespeare, you can imagine how many times there were sort of mini explosions in her brain.
And who can't relate to that? And yet she came up with this. Can you get a sense of progression here about how she found her voice? I mean, she's not doing this in a whirl of poets in Greenwich Village or whatever that might have been at the time. She's doing this more or less in solitude.
In Greenwich Village, you can't find solitude.
No, right.
She was lucky to have it because writing demands that you be alone in a room. And that's why very few people can write a lot, because you have to be alone, and most people are more gregarious than that.
They are, but when I read her, I feel at once really exalted and at the same time very mundane. I mean, her mind is so, and her use of language and the way she leaps through concepts and you know, I don't know, the soul with such spare language and such imaginative sort of juxtapositions. Where does that come from?
I think in her, much of it comes from rebellion. She reads so much. She spends her whole life reading. And then she thinks, that's not what I think hope is. Something as abstract as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. If I look into my heart and think about hope, what is it? It's a little melody that never stops, unlike every other melody. It keeps going. And yet it's only a melody. It doesn't have ideas. Poems don't have ideas as such. They have melody into which ideas, like all the other raw material, words, etymologies, and whatnot, are woven. But it's up to her, really, to supply the words that hope itself cannot. So when she writes a poem, she is giving voice to an emotion, you might say, that can't speak for itself, although it sings a melody of its own.
And maybe in rebellion, which may account for her, her quite free sense of how to approach ideas, language, everything.
Yes, she's very free. Luckily, she hadn't been taught. I think often it's bad to be taught. For original spirits, they can that way escape the contamination of groupthink.
Tell us about another poem, Now I Knew I Lost Her.
This is one, a poem that peers into one of the corners rarely written about. We have lots of poems of love, we have lots of poems of loss. However, what is it like to lose someone but not lose them physically, lose them emotionally while they're right next to you physically?
Something breaks, something floats away.
Something is gone, and yet it is unacknowledged on both sides. Most people think this is about her sister-in-law, Susan. They lived in adjoining houses. But there was a break between them. We don't know all the reasons. But this is about somebody that you see every day, really, and greet and talk to, and yet the warmth has completely gone out of the relationship.
Will you read for us?
Yes. Now I knew I lost her. Not that she was gone, but remoteness traveled on her face and tongue. Alien, though adjoining, as a foreign race, traversed she, though pausing, latitudeless place. Elements unaltered, universe the same, but love's transmigration, somehow this had come. Henceforth, to remember, nature took the day I had paid so much for. His is penury, not who toils for freedom or for family, but the restitution of idolatry.
Helen Vendler reading Emily Dickinson's Now I Knew I Lost Her. Remoteness traveled on her face and tongue. And there, it's not so hard to follow, but by the time she comes to the end, the restitution of idolatry. Help us.
We don't know that the person who has been lost had been idolized literally to that extent. She uses the word idolater in a letter about Susan, the only time she uses the word, except here, yes, and thought of as a kindred spirit for someone who lacked kindred spirits in the household. And then the chill of some sort descended on the relationship. And at the end, you recognize that the poet has recognized that the relationship was, you might say, inappropriate. You don't idolize or idolatrize, there's such a word, another human being.
She's paying in a way.
She's paying for having sinned. Thou shalt have no gods before me. It's
right,
the first commandment.
Right, idolatry, right
and
there.
And she sets up idolatry, yes. And but she doesn't come to that acknowledgement till the very last word of the poem.
Yeah. Now, here you are, a great scholar of poetry. You've got nearly 1,800 poems, so not even 1 in 10 make your cut. So how did you decide that this one must?
I think everyone has had this experience. It could be somebody in school with you, somebody in the family, somebody, a colleague that you have treated as someone beloved or have enshrined as someone beloved, and then suddenly the chill descends. Everyone knows that experience. And this was one of the poems that struck me when I was extremely young.
something subtle but very, very powerful and almost universally known at some time in the course of a lifetime.
Yes.
Candace in Bedford, Massachusetts. Candace, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for calling.
I love your work, Ms. Vendler, and thank you. I've loved it. And also, Mr. Ashbrook, wonderful. I have a tome that I opened up to last night. It's sort of the opposite. I can definitely relate to the having the person there and gone yet. what the poem you just read, I'm not being very eloquent. Yeah. But this is about physical loss where a person has died, and we've recently experienced a death in our family.
Sorry, Kim.
It's a very short poem, but very beautiful. And it it's sort of, I remember when my father died at a very young age, someone said to me, trying to help, time heals all wounds, but this is the anti that.
So you're in mourning, in fact, now yourself, and you've turned to this, and what poem is it again? Tell us, Candace.
It's in the Johnson edition, the number 686, and the first line is, they say that time assuages.
Will you read it for us?
Sure. They say that time assuages. Time never did assuage, and actual suffering strengthens as sinews do with age. Time is a test of trouble, but not a remedy. If such it prove, it proved too, there was no malady.
Suffering strengthens with age. You're in a time of pain. Is that comforting, Candace, or the opposite?
It's, I think when you're just living with someone just dying, you just you want their physical being back,
and
the world around you is just sort of expecting you to get on with things, and this says that you really do never get over it. In a way, it's saying that there's sort of a lack of hope, but it's being so honest that, you know, when we lose someone we love, they're in a way they're with us all the time, but that physical absence is so painful.
But there's a kind of respect for the depth of the relationship that was Helen?
Yes, this is another mark of her defiance. People are always saying you should move on, etc.
Time heals all wounds.
Time heals
She's
all
not
wounds.
Going rolling with that.
Yes, and she's sitting there mutely in some company where somebody says that, and she thinks that's a lie. And she bursts out, they say the time assuages. Time never did assuage. And when she says that suffering strengthens you, as sinews are strengthened with age, for a minute I didn't understand that, but she means children get stronger as they grow up and get their full strength of manhood.
Mm-hmm.
So in passing from trivial sufferings to a deep and irremediable suffering, as the caller has just mentioned, you come into your emotional adulthood. You have the strength that you didn't have as a child, and it comes from suffering.
Candace, we wish you strength, and we're very happy for your call. One on the short list that we get to hear in this hour from your short list, very short list, Helen, is one of her most famous, Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers. This, of course, speaks of the dead. Here's written in 1859. Here's a recording of it by the sitting poet laureate, Kay Ryan.
Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning, untouched by noon, lie the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. Grand go the years in the crescent above them. Worlds scoop their arcs, and firmaments row, diadems drop, and doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow.
U.S. Poet Laureate Kay Ryan reading Emily Dickinson's Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers. And here Helen Vendler, she's getting just about as cosmic as you can be.
Yes, I want to thank the Poet Laureate Kay Ryan for her beautiful voice and her beautiful reading. She has a very warm voice and a very, of course, deep understanding of the poem. She chose, Emily Dickinson wrote four different versions of stanza two of this poem. And
Grand go the years crescent above them, the dead.
Yes. That sets the dead against the whole universe,
rolling
planets
on.
And everything else. And it sets it against the great of this world where the doge dies, and the diadem, the queen's diadem, falls. So that it's set in the universal cosmic world and also set in the world of great ones on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things happen, and to the dead, they're soundless. The dead can't any longer hear anything. And if you can imagine, say, raindrops on a disk of snow, they would make no noise as they made their little circles, dots on a disk of snow.
Yeah. Sleep there, the meek members of the resurrection. But she was not, in any sense, an orthodox believer.
No, she changed sleep to lie, because falling asleep in Christ, as St. Paul says, is the way it's put. And then if you don't believe in Christ, you perish. And so that when she wrote the first version, she set the dead not against the universe and the great men and women, but rather against nature. And she says, she uses St. Paul's word, perish, that he uses of the unbeliever. Light laughs the breeze in her castle above them, babbles the bee in a stolid ear, pipe the sweet birds in ignorant cadence. Ah, what sagacity perished here. She also revised sleep to lie, so that lie, the meek members of the resurrection, satirizes them. They're not going to wake up from their sleep.
Let's go to David in Manchester, Connecticut. David, you're on the air with Helen Vendler.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I liked very much what was said earlier about Dickinson's rebelliousness, because I think that is so... that is really predominant in her poetry on many topics, and particularly what strikes me is her views of religion. Throughout her life, and as reflected in her poetry, there are several poems that really indicate a reluctance. She certainly was not a traditional Christian, and it's quite evident in at least a couple of poems that I'm familiar with.
And do you find an alternate cosmic view here beyond mere rebellion, David?
Yes, I think she somewhat came to resolve her what I would call her conflicts about traditional Christianity in terms of believing very much in the presence of something divine in nature. But I'm struck by how daring she was in a couple of her poems in terms of how she describes, let's say, a typical sermon.
Yeah, she was absolutely fearless, and I thank you for your call. Helen Vendler, what about nature as the ultimate in the Dickinson world?
Nature is both good and bad. If it's a nature, it's a Manichaean nature, you could say, unlike the Christian God, who does not have an evil side, but the Manichaean religion separated. There were two principles, one good and one evil, in perpetual struggle in the universe. And so her sense of nature is a very ample one, in that it includes the principle of nature's destructiveness as well as nature's creation, you might say.
But there's a point at which you say there's no evil side to the Christian God, but in Dickinson's description, I'm reading you last night, at some point she toys even with that God.
Of course, but that's the thing she was thinking when she sat in church listening to those sermons.
Well, even suggesting that some evil may apply?
Only as a joke. She makes jokes about the arguments that God is evil, like commanding Abraham to kill Isaac. So she writes a parody, Abraham to kill him was distinctly told. Isaac was a youngster. Yeah. Abraham was old. I mean, she tells the story in this, I've forgotten what Isaac was exactly.
I know what you're referring to. I just can't find it myself at just this moment. We'll come back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the poetry of Emily Dickinson, truly an American original, with the great poetry scholar Helen Vendler, her new collection is Dickinson Selected Poems and Commentaries. Let's go to Hartsville, South Carolina, and Dan. Dan, you're on the air with Helen Vendler.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, Helen. I'm loving the conversation. I'd like to talk for a second about the poem. The first line is, "The soul selects her own society." And I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it goes, the first few lines, "The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door to her divine majority, present no more." But the deftness of her language and the sneakiness of it just amazes me, because when you pronounce the word present without thinking, you've already selected interpretation, because it could just as easily be present.
She's sneaky, you say, and the soul selecting her own society, very...
Well, you know, and that poem is usually read romantically, but
yes.
I see it as a rejection of both romance and God, because the first line, "the soul selects her own society," most people see as romantic, but I think she's saying the soul selects her own.
That's a very interesting interpretation. Helen, what do you say to this and the poem?
It's a poem that says that the soul and her society constitute a majority, in fact, a divine majority, and that's all she needs, the soul. Present no more to her. I think it has to be present because of the metrical accent, da-dum, so it can't be present. It
a divine majority, and yet it sounds sort of like humanism, a definition
well,
nearly.
For her, the divine majority is a majority of two, which, of course, is also a joke since the proverb is a majority of one. She also is, you might say, riffing on the notion of predestination, in which God selects his own society. They are the elect, and all the others will be damned, the usual Calvinist theory of predestination.
She says no.
God is out of this poem, at least.
Right.
I have a divine majority, and it's the one I choose, and it's a majority of two, and that is what I will generalize. The soul selects her own society, but by the time she gets to the rejection of the chariots that pause at her gate trying to make her come out and join their society, or the emperor who is kneeling on her mat. The emperor gets as far as the front door and kneels on her mat, kneels instead of just pausing like the chariots, and he's a single most powerful person in the society,
yes.
The emperor. She doesn't open the door. And then the first person comes into the poem for the first time in the third stanza. "I've known her from an ample nation. Choose one." And that's when you realize the divine majority is a majority of two. "Then close the valves of her attention like stone." And those two strong beats at the end.
Like stone.
Like stone. The valves are the heart valves that open and close, and she is not going to let anyone else into her heart.
Talk about strong, Den, thank you for your call. You talk about strong beats at the end. Just the strength of this poet. It seems, you know, it conflicts in our minds with a sort of Victorian recluse. What someone described her, was it Mabel Todd, who later brought some of her letters out as almost like a Miss Havisham figure? And yet this is cosmic strength.
She was very funny. She wasn't a Miss Havisham figure at all. It's true she lived in her father's house, as most unmarried women of that time did.
Yes.
But she was known for her wit and her jokes, and
don't mess with her.
I mean, you can imagine how witty she is in conversation when you read the poems. So I don't think she's not a recluse in the usual sense. She is keeping her wit alive in her writings as well as in her conversation with the family.
Her wit, her cosmic wit here. Maria in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Maria, you're on the air with Helen Vendler.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Helen. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if Helen could speak a little bit about influences of Dickinson on 20th century poetry. I was always struck by the resemblance between Emily Dickinson's poem that was read earlier on the air, "The Brain is Wider Than the Sky," and Edna St. Vincent Millay's poem, "Renaissance." "The world stands out on either side, no wider than the heart is wide. Above the world is stretched the sky, no higher than the soul is high." I was wondering if Helen could speak a little bit about such visible traces of Dickinson in 20th century poetry.
Yes, please. And thanks, Maria.
Thanks to you, Maria. That's a big subject. Almost every female poet in America has written a poem about Emily Dickinson or has imitated Emily Dickinson in some other way. You may know Adrienne Rich's poem, you might say defiant in itself, rejecting Higginson's description of Emily Dickinson as my half-cracked poetess. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine what Edrin Rich makes of that. Mm-hmm. And Lucy Brock Broido, a wonderful poet of Cambridge, has imitated in homage the master letters, those three cryptic letters of Emily Dickinson that were never perhaps mailed, but of which we have all three in draft, so that there are others. I think Galway Kinnell was it who wrote a funny poem called For the Marriage of Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman.
Oh, boy. Disgraceful, but yes. Married in his mind's eye.
That's right. I mean, that they are the two great generators of American poetry. So I think that it's hard to, and I'm sure there are many other poems I'm not remembering right now, but it's hard to escape her influence, just as it was hard for people in Ireland to escape the influence of Yeats. He was there like the big monolith, and Whitman and Dickinson are there like two great Stonehenge figures, and you can't ignore them.
Did she free poets that came after, or trap them in that form? She
all influences both, as you know.
Yes.
It's both creative and intimidating. Mm-hmm. And but she was not one to be intimidated, so why should anyone influenced by her, be intimidated.
Maria, thanks so much for your call. Would you read one more for us? A Visitor in Mull. It changes the subject matter a little bit here, but maybe that's good.
This is one of the Nature as Destroyer poems mentioned earlier. And also, it's a poem that speaks of not only the principle of the frost-nipped flower, which again goes back to George Herbert as an old image, but the frost is generally presented as white. This frost is dark and black. He comes in marl. That's the material, sort of asphalt-like material, out of which the floor of Pandemonium, where the devils live in paradise,
in
lost.
Hell. Mm-hmm.
In hell.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And the poem shows the flowers as being first very much enhanced by being frozen. They become very elegant and rigid and glistening with frost.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, we know the consequence. A visitor in Marl who influences flowers till they are orderly as busts and elegant as glass, who visits in the night and just before the sun concludes his glistening interview, caresses and is gone. But whom his fingers touch, and where his feet have run, and whatsoever mouth he kissed, is as it had not been. We first see the flowers preserved in frozen form,
marvelous.
But by the end we see them as annihilated, literally. They are as if they had not been. They go away from sight altogether as they decay, and the field is bare. And
we have the sense of her loving nature, of loving being in nature, but here, as you say, this is the wholly destructive power.
Yes, she watches everything very closely, and she loves the cusp of the seasons. When one season turns into another, here's summer turning into winter at the first frost. As when the caller asked about poets that had borrowed from Dickinson, the idea of writing about the cusp of a season was borrowed from her extensively by Wallace Stevens, who writes lots and lots of poems about the very moment, the earliest ending of winter, as he calls it, rather than calling it the beginning of spring. So it's that wonderful moment of turn.
Helen Vendler, what do you take most from this poetess, half-cracked or not? If this is half-cracked, bring it on, I say. but you know, here you've done this great work. What do you take as the essential, I don't know, if is it possible, lesson away? Is it rebellion?
Well, my feeling, it's not so much a lesson of her life as a lesson of the variety of which lyric is capable. She writes in almost every known lyric genre, the love poem, the patriotic poem, the death poem, the elegy, the nature poem, the definition poem, so that you see, and they're quite short, so that you see how much the lyric encompasses of the world, how much can come and much remain. How much can come, how much can go, and yet remain the world, she says. So that it's like a world. You forget the poems in between.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly finding ones you have forgotten if you go back to the 1800s.
A universe, an amazing universe. Helen Vendler is professor of English at Harvard. Her wonderful big new book is Dickinson, Selected Poems and commentaries. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Professor Vendler, it's just been a great privilege and honor to have you with us today. Thank you so very much for coming.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure to talk about Emily Dickinson with you and with the callers.
Just fantastic. Thank you so very much. I want to turn now to San Diego, California, and Ray Armantrout. She's the winner of the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for poetry. She's from the School of Language Poets out of California, a far cry, in many instances, from Dickinson's lyric poetry in New England. But Armantrout says the poems still speak to her, that she feels a kind of kinship. She joins us now from San Diego, California. Ray Armantrout, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you with us again. Have you got an Emily Dickinson poem that you'd read for us?
Sure, I have two, but I want to start out with the one that's numbered 1068 by Johnson, Further in Summer Than the Birds.
Wonderful. Let's hear it.
Further in summer than the birds, pathetic from the grass, a minor nation celebrates its unobtrusive mass. No ordinance be seen, so gradual the grace, a pensive custom it becomes, enlarging loneliness. Antiquest felt at noon, when August burning low, arise this spectral canticle, repose to typify. Remit as yet no grace, no furrow on the glow, yet a druidic difference enhances nature now.
Further in summer than the birds, Ray, there by this year's Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry, Ray Armantrout. And tell us, oh great Pulitzer Prize winner, what draws you to this one?
Well, it's an example of many of the things I love about Dickinson. I mean, I like a poem to surprise me, and no one is more startling than Dickinson, especially in the way that she will combine two words together that you will never see combined anywhere else. For instance, spectral canticle, or enlarging loneliness, or no furrow on the glow. I mean, you know, this is the only place you're ever going to hear those phrases is in this poem. So she is just startlingly original and mysterious. I mean, one thing that you might notice about that poem is that it's a kind of a riddle. I think she's talking about crickets. I mean, we know she is because she sent this poem along with a pressed cricket. But even if you didn't know that, you could figure out that she was talking about insects doing a song in the grass, but it would take you a little while. I mean,
Further in summer than the birds, maybe later in summer, and pathetic from the grass. There's the cricket down on the ground.
Yeah, it's on the grass.
A minor nation celebrating.
and you don't really know for sure that it's singing until you hear spectral canticles, which is a wonderful phrase.
It sure is.
But so she withholds the sort of subject noun topic and lets you come around to it, you know, through the way that she characterizes the thing, which adds a kind of mystery to it and makes you more alert, I think, as you come into the poem. I think she wanted us to see life's strangeness, and she certainly helps us do that.
Is it surprising, is it contradictory that a language poet like yourself would be inspired by Emily Dickinson? Is there a contradiction there or not?
No. I mean, first of all, I don't feel like I have to adhere to any particular rules or that I am exactly like any other poet. But that said, there's no one who pays more attention to language and uses it in sometimes a very unorthodox way. No one does that more than Dickinson. I mean, she feels free to wrench a word out of its usual context or usage or even meaning to suit herself. For instance, in this line where she says, when autumn burning low, arise this spectral canticle. Shouldn't it be this spectral canticle arises?
Mm-hmm,
I mean, arise, the command
form. It's like Yoda.
Yeah, I know. Or it's like, you know, take up thy bed and walk, arise. Mm-hmm. It's something either magical or religious. That command form there is startling, and it's unconventional. So she wasn't afraid to make unconventional uses of language.
And they crack our minds wide open. You've got one more. I want to get to it before our time runs down.
Okay.
A wind that rose. Tell us and read.
Yes. Okay. And this one is perhaps even more mysterious. In the other one, we can figure out that she's talking about insects, probably crickets. Mm-hmm. In the second one, she's talking about an interior experience that she never specifies. She describes it metaphorically, and we have to imagine
read,
what
madam,
it might
our,
be.
Our clock is brutal.
Okay. All right. A wind that rose, though not a leaf in any forest stirred, but with itself did cold engage beyond the realm of bird. A wind that woke a lone delight, like separation swell, restored in arctic confidence to the invisible.
A wind that doesn't even shake the leaf, restored an arctic confidence to the invisible. It's not crickets. What's your best?
No.
What's your best guess? Where are we? What zone are we in here?
Well, I think we're in Dickinson's mind, and my guess would be that she's talking about her own writing process, her own inspiration, and what becomes of it, and the pleasure that she takes in it, whether or not it ever sees the light of day in the form of publication. But that's just a guess. I mean, she leaves lots of space for the reader to bring in their own experience here. You know, their own. Maybe private love, for instance.
A wind that woke a lone delight. Wow, that is just fantastic. Ray Armantrout, you're always so generous with us, and it's been great to hear you read Dickinson today. It's very kind of you to join us. Thank you so much for your inspired thoughts and time.
Thank you for having me again.
2010 Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry, Ray Armantrout, joining us there from San Diego. And our thanks to Helen Vendler as well of Harvard for her time and wonderful insights today on Emily Dickinson. Listeners, thank you so very much for joining us and for your own recitations. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.